Check, check.
Ding.
If you could just kind of give a brief description of your history with the Kansas Zen Center, when you started going, how long you've been going there, how active you are, etc.
I can't remember exactly the year. My experience stems partially from, reading writings of authors. Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder kind of introduced me to the idea of what it was all about in the Dharma Bums novel years and years ago. And then when I got to to Lawrence, returning after being gone for probably 8 to 10 years, I had been using a lot of alcohol, and I quit drinking. And so once I started this like new phase of my life, that's where I kind of opened up to the idea of meditation. I actually had a good friend of mine years ago tell me that, you'd really benefit from Zazen, and that's the Japanese word for it. So Stan, the one of the teachers there, Stan Lombardo, gave a class called Introduction to Zen, Buddhism, and it was like an hour one week at night, and then an hour the next week, and then they had a retreat, a one-day retreat. And I remember walking to the retreat and just, feeling like, even just walking to the retreat, I felt Zen. And since then, my experience has been that, when you go into a situation like that, you have all these expectations. A normal world that we live in, we want to put a label on things. We want to know what to expect. We want to know whatever, And the Zen experience is something that I'm finding that that'll lead you astray, That's exactly kind of the opposite of what you want to be doing. And Zen deals directly with cutting through opposites thinking, and putting labels on things. And it can go as deep as you want it to. I remember one day trying to suss out, what trying to expect what see what I can expect, and being told that, this practice never ends. It will go on for the rest of your life. It's not like you just one day you get everything you need and you can walk away from it. It's something that you come back to every day. And so as far as my experience with it has been, I've come and gone. There's been times when I go a lot more, and there's times when I don't go. It's kind of always in the back of my mind that I should be going more, but I think everybody does that. We're always wanting to help ourselves more than we'll let ourselves at times. But it's always there, and that's something that I've been really happy about in having the Kansas Zen Center here in Lawrence, as it's really a gift, I mean, right in my neighborhood. Right there, active teachers, and it's an international school to have access to. So that's sort of in a nutshell. It's like the Zen Center's there, and I can go whenever I want, and I don't go as much as I want to. Well, that's sort of like humanity's response to life in general. Like we could be able to live our lives as free and able to go anywhere, but we end up learning to confine ourselves to ideas and patterns, and believing that we're something, or that's that, or this is a pen, or it's everything has a label, and we form our world around these ideas, where and that's where I think my experience, part of the practice is called Kongans, interviews, where if you do a retreat. And also on Sunday practices, the teacher, either Stan or Judy, will go into a separate room and call each person in one at a time. And you come in and sit face to face, and it's an interview situation that there's a lot more going on there than you know at first. But, they're basically examining your mind and seeing if they can trip you up. Basically, see if they can make you think. And catch you doing it and point it out to you, that why do you do that? Why is that that? That isn't that. No, it's not. Like what? And I don't want to tell you too much because that's half the fun of just getting in there and experiencing, especially when, say, you have an experience of the teacher you know, posing a question to you that you get a correct answer to. And then you see how way too much we think, overthink things and assume. And so to me, that's the beauty of the Zen experience, especially having it there and trying to get to it and always getting distracted, you know. That's the problem. That's the main problem in both levels, you know. So
do you find that in those interviews, do you find that afterwards you're wanting to meditate on those questions, or you're wanting to think about what they said? And are you supposed to be thinking about what they said, or are you supposed to just leave it there and go back to your Zazen?
I think it's a little of both. Certain traditions in Zen, you know, there's lots of different schools. It all branched off of Buddhism in general, you know, started in India, or Buddha was in India, and then he gave transmission to a disciple, and then that disciple gave transmission to another disciple, and on over the years. And I think it was the 28th one, his name was Bodhidharma, and he traveled from India to China and took Buddhism to China. And he was the first one that I know of, or that I've studied, that really used meditation as a tool, and also realized that the idea of self, or the idea of attaining anything or getting something out of the experience, was the wrong idea, you know. And he was probably the first Zen patriarch. Now, after that happened, you know, he gave transmission to his disciple, and I think it was a few more past him, the Hui Neng, who I think was the sixth Zen patriarch after Bodhidharma, really defined what the Zen, you know, school was kind of about. But since then, there's been so many different masters and so many different schools that you could say, I'm going to this Kwannon Korean school in Lawrence, even though it came down the same, you know, line as all these other ones. Say if I went to a Japanese Zen temple, I would find a completely different way of doing things, you know. So one school might say, yes, go back and focus on that, you know, meditate on that. You know, when you're meditating, breathe in, think about the question, you know. But I've had Stan and Judy say, no, don't do that. Don't meditate on the question, just breathe. You know, so there's lots of different, even within the Zen experience, there's lots of different ways and approaches. So mostly when I walk out of the interview, I'm frustrated and perplexed, and you want to get something, you know, you want to walk away with something, but you don't always get it. You know, it's more like that's what's standing in your way. that pressure we feel, you know, like if you or I were to, I don't know how you are, but if we were to sit here at this table and try not to talk to each other, it would be very hard after a while. The silence would get overwhelming, you know, we need to interact, we need to sort of define where we are. And I think that what they're trying to teach in this school anyway is that, you know, to not expect anything. The questions will come when they come. Stan tells me it's like there's a hole in the wall, and you know that the mouse is in there, and you're just waiting for the mouse to come out. So you have to sit there and watch that hole with all your energy that you have, and don't give up, and keep on it, keep sitting, you know. And you don't really know what to expect. That's hard to do if you don't have some assurance that anything's going to come through for you. I think that's one of the most difficult things about the practice. So, you know, we have a sort of a rule, unwritten rule in the school that, you know, there's a list of 10 kongons that our master Sungsan from Korea, he calls the 10 gates, and each one sort of tests your mind in a different way. And so we start off at the first gate and go to the second gate and the third gate, and you have to graduate through each kongon before you can move on to the next one. And so, you know, my first kongon I worked on for probably 2 years before I realized the correct answer. And those sort of things just come when they come, and there's no way to force it, you know. I don't think we're really used to that experience of not being in control of the outcome, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and to me, that's the allure of the experience, is that's the thing that wears me out, is constantly seeking and wanting and trying to, you know, what do I want to do? I'm a person who, you know, is capable of a lot of different things and has a lot of ideas and wants to do a lot of things, but it ends up making your life way too busy and way too involved, and maybe more so than you wanted it to be, you know? Mm-hmm. So Zen and the Buddhist study in general is just sort of a refuge from all of that, you know, if you let yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you were, you mentioned some books that you read very early on.
Mm-hmm.
When you were doing that early study, did you read into other forms of Buddhism?
Well, one great thing that they did there, other than Zen, you mean?
Other than Zen, yeah.
A little bit. You know, there's, in China, there's Hinayana and Mahayana are the names, and I'm pretty sure that Zen is a Mahayana. Hinayana, one of them is like, you chant and pray to be delivered to some sort of heaven, you know, the Western paradise. And by chanting to Amida Butsu or Amida Bull, Namu, we say it Namu Amida Bull in our chants, is sort of chanting to Buddha and gaining something from it as a reward, you know. But so I have studied sort of the different forms, the Indian Buddhism. Not so much. One great thing that they've done there when I first started going a few years ago was there's a book called the Zen Source Book that Stan and I think Judy worked on, that they rounded up all of the really rare Zen literature through most of its development history through China and Korea and Japan. And they taught a class over the course of a year. Once a month, and we studied all the different masters in Zen. But beyond that, no, I haven't really, in my own experience.
So no practice outside of Zen?
Like, not really, okay. No. And I'm not really sure. I mean, that brings up a good question is, you know, what other, in America especially, what other options are there? I mean, you know, you don't have to answer that question, but to me, it's like I went out to Oregon, to Portland, and found a Zen temple and wanted to go because it sounded so completely different than what we do here. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Different forms. So, but not really. I would definitely say there's people at the Zen Center that have experienced more of it than I have, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all relative. I find myself, after practicing and meditating, that there is a way to be able to take that practice and kind of have it blend into your life.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't necessarily have to meditate to... and see, I don't even really know what the word is for it.
Yeah.
Whatever it is we're trying to do there in the school,
mm-hmm.
it's possible outside of the school also. But mm-hmm. it takes, you know, a lot of discipline to be able to kind of keep the focus on what you're really trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think so much, one of the things that really interests me about Zen is it's so... you know, you can take it black and white and say, well, it's telling me that I need to get rid of everything I own and detach and not care what happens to me or anyone else and not have any ambition and do by not doing and just exist in this weird space where I'm not even really me, you know. And but that's kind of black and white thinking, you know. I think the real skill is figuring out how to do that while existing in your normal, you know, in the society that we live in, that mm-hmm. it's so bent on kind of, you know, making something of yourself and attaining and getting things and mm-hmm. and wanting and that kind of stuff. So,
mm-hmm. In your own, you mentioned kind of being out in the world mm-hmm. apart from meditation with the group. in your own meditation in the group, or your, you know, maybe your practice outside of the group if there is one, do you do anything that you, that's kind of unique, that maybe the group, that maybe, do you do anything that, to adapt what the group teaches to yourself because it feels better or works for you more?
Sure. And we're free to do that kind of stuff. I mean, really all you have is, we have our practice. If you want me to tell you kind of what we do there, you went to practice once, but you know, practice usually revolves around bowing, chanting, and, sitting meditation. If you do really long sitting meditations, there's also walking meditation, which is mostly, I think, just to give your legs and hips a rest from sitting for so long. But, so really all you have there is, you know, chanting, you're reading out of a book, you can memorize the chants, which eventually you do, but essentially you could be chanting anything. It's in Korean. Mm-hmm. I mean, so half the time I don't even really know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. but we do it anyway, you know. Bowing, you know, there's a certain way that we bow. We do have forms, you know, you bow this way, you're supposed to hold your hands like this and cross your feet if you can, and different things for every bow, but, you know, the practices I go to, we bow 108 times in the morning, and then we chant a morning bell chant, and then we sit for 20 minutes. When you're sitting, there's a way you can sit, but they're pretty, you know, kind of, there's a form for doing that, unless you have some kind of injury that makes you want to sit different, or even stand, because you can't handle it. But how your body is kind of secondary to how your breathing is. And what they point you to do is to quit focusing up here and to focus down here right below your belly button, which would be like one of the chakras, or we call it the Tanjin, Tanden, and it's an energy center that you can feel when you breathe with your belly, you know, and that's when I try to get a posture that you can really feel that muscle, but... trying to get that focus down into your belly and take your thinking off of your mind and more into your body and into your breath. And so, you know, when we first start, they say count, inhale to 3 and then exhale 7. And so I would do that just rigidly. And then pretty soon he would, Stan would say, Sung San said, what he liked to say was, when you breathe in, think, what am I? Or what is this? And then when you breathe out, say, don't know. And don't know is a big, big thing in Zen. You know, you're you, I'm me, we all have our own ideas, but we think we know. We've constructed these illusions about a reality that we're, you know, you look at what's going on in the world. Some people say this is our religion, and we're willing to fight this other religion to the death and kill people and torture to make sure that we know this is it. You know, so don't know takes us down to this level where all that's gone, and we're just, you know, our base reality that's below all of that. So, well, you could do that, but I found myself in one retreat getting tripped up by thinking don't know. And so I brought that up to Stan in an interview, and he said that you're penetrating don't know. So now don't say don't know anymore, just be don't know, you know. So there's these levels. It's almost like there are forms, but what you find is no matter which way you do it, you're starting to peel away these layers and get into deeper and deeper understandings. And I don't think that ever really ends, you know. When you examine this sort of thing. So I hope I answered your question. It's like there are forms, but like each person has to do it their own way. Mm-hmm. You know, some people will get it right away, and some people will take their whole lifetime mm-hmm. to get there and then get it right away. Mm-hmm. You know, And that's a big, big thing is sudden realization or gradual realization. Mm-hmm. So each one's individual.
Yeah,
you know, each of us is individual.
So. You mentioned the chanting, mm-hmm. and you mentioned it being in Korean.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any significance in the fact that it is in Korean, and that there are portions of the service not translated into English?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it definitely helps for me, speaking English all the time, that you're not thinking about the words. We do chant one chant, the Heart Sutra, we do chant in English, which sounds really weird and wonky in English. When you chant it in Korean, the rhythm is really nice, and then you try to do it in English, and it just, I almost don't like it, you know, but we do it anyway. But it being in Korean, because our teacher is Korean, but then another one of the teachers in our school, Dae Kwong, he lives in Malaysia, I think. He was the abbot of our school for a while. He told me, you know, we were talking about Korean. Do you understand Korean? And he said, it doesn't matter because the Korean is just a translation of Chinese. So even the Korean people don't even really know what they're chanting because they're chanting Chinese Korean style, mm-hmm. you know. So there is all of that. The thing that I'm finding as I go along is that the bowing is really, the effect of the bowing, I kind of poo-pooed at first. Why do we bow so many times? I looked at it as like exercise. Mm-hmm. It's a great thing to do in the morning. I had an experience in the first retreat I was in, the first long retreat, where I had to get up and leave because I couldn't handle it anymore, you know, mm-hmm. sitting with myself. I was running into some real difficulty in my mind, sitting there with what was going on inside of me, kind of looking back on my life and the experiences I've had and emotions and things like that. And bowing can do that too. I don't know how, but I found sometimes when I'm bowing that you'll get that. You experience emotions. I don't know how it works. It's very strange to do that repetitive motion. So I don't know, maybe it's all designed, perfectly designed, you know, to get you right there. You know, they know what they're doing. When we walk in off the street and you take a look at what goes on in the room, you're like, wow, this is really strange. You know, why it's so simple, so quiet. There's nothing in the room. We're not doing anything. We're chanting in some weird language. We're bowing innumerable times and we're sitting staring at the floor. But, it's potentially like the best therapy there is, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. Yeah. So,
in your experience, would you yourself identify as being a Buddhist?
No, yeah. Not really. Only because, I'm really not sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say I would aspire to be a Buddhist, mm-hmm. you know, that ultimate attainment is something to be seen, mm-hmm. you know? It's sort of like you can't be something that you're not. I could say that I am, but you're falling in the trap of mm-hmm. words, you know? Like, okay, so I tell you I'm a Buddhist. Mm-hmm. What happens when I walk out the door? Mm-hmm. I'm going to get pissed at something. I'm going to get mad. I'm going to act like a human being. I'm going to want something. I'm going to turn around and completely stomp on that. Mm-hmm. I can keep trying to do that, and that's what practice is all about. You know, you keep mm-hmm. coming around to it. And so it's sort of like Buddhism, Zen, as far as I'm, you know, Buddhism is a way of realizing suffering. You know, Buddha, his life was that, you know, he was a prince, or was going to be a king. He didn't want it. He tried to give it all up. Couldn't do that either. And sort of found a middle way, and then he sat on it for a while and tried to figure out, and he ultimately came up with the reason why we're all bummed out is we want too much, or we don't understand what's really happening here, you know. And his first transmission to, I think it was, and here's the words, I think it's Mahasakyapa, the second disciple, he twirled a flower and looked on this crowd of people, and Mahasakyapa smiled. And Buddha knew that he got it. He was saying something to this crowd by twirling this flower around. And he knew, he could tell without words that this other person got what he was saying. So it kind of all boils down to every practice that we start there starts with the four vows. And the four vows are... now I can't remember. I'm at the context. It says, sentient beings are numberless. We vow to save them all. delusions are endless. We vow to cut through them all. The teachings are infinite. We vow to learn them all. And the Buddha way is inconceivable, but we vow to attain it. So each one is like a paradox. Mm-hmm. You know, you're saying there's an innumerable teachings and we want to learn them all. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of, that's your path. You know that it's basically your, even if you do it, you aren't really doing it because there's no way to really do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's because of how you're thinking about it, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't see that at first, and I think that's what that is, that sort of unfolding. Probably one of my, just me as a person, I would say, no, I'm not a Buddhist because I'm not a, what do you call it, I'm like a fence sitter. Mm-hmm. I don't really like to jump to one side or the other, and maybe that makes me a good Buddhist, I don't know. I'm not that way all the time. But when it's something like this, like you're trying to understand something that can't be understood, you know, where does that leave you? You know, a lot of our Kong-on say, if you open your mouth, you're already dead. You know, the teacher will say, if you answer, I'll hit you. If you don't answer, I'll hit you. Meaning, you know, there's something here you aren't seeing yet. Mm-hmm. And I really can't point it out to you. You have to find it for yourself, and when you do, I'll say, you got it. But until that point, you know, a teacher isn't there to sort of show you how it's done. They're sort of more there to kind of, you know, give you a little nudge in the right direction or ask you a really well-placed question, you know, because mm-hmm. they know, like, a good metaphor is, you know, they've stuck their hand in the stream of water, and they know if it's cold or hot, mm-hmm. and they want you to be able to put your hand in, without telling you the water's cold, you know, you put your own hand in there and go, oh, the water's cold, and oh, so we all see now, you know, the same thing. So it's very perplexing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's very attractive too. I mean, I was just with my son at the Weebelos camp, and it's Boy Scouts, faith-based. It's a faith-based organization. And day two, we had to, after breakfast, chapel service, and I'm ready to run out the door, man. I don't know why. I'm just averse. I don't want to sit in church. They didn't tell us we had to go to church, you know. And I'm not trying to make a scene here, but if it's faith-based, whose faith? You know, which one? I mean, there's so many. I guess my view of it is that Buddhism's great because it's kind of not one of those ones, really. I mean, and I could be wrong. You know, I'm sure there's people that feel differently than I do about it, but anyway.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to...
Okay. Yeah, I hope I'm answering your questions. Yeah. Okay.